National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Even in a pandemic, the battle over abortion in the United States is vivid. First, abortion businesses pushed to be recognized as essential services, and next, Planned Parenthood applied for federal relief funds. The Trump administration has pushed back. Register reporter Loretta Brown brings us the story. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen. Matthew, right now the maxim, never waste a good crisis, certainly comes to mind when I think of abortion politics that have been on display right now.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, and in D.C. it's usually more true. So that's obviously where you are. But before we talk to Loretta Brown, who's also in Washington, D.C., she's our national correspondent, before we talk to her about this abortion politics that have these abortion politics that have been on display, there's some good news related to church reopening that I think we should talk about.
Well, you're right. This week, the governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, made a rather abrupt about turn and decided, after all, to allow churches in the state to open. This came, of course, after the bishops of the state announced that they would defy his opening plan that had placed church openings behind casinos and tattoo parlors, which got the attention of quite a few people. There are important really constitutional and cultural ramifications in how states are reopening, and we've been following, obviously, the controversies very closely at the National Catholic Register. But we thought that to help us understand everything that is happening, including the legal and constitutional dimensions of the reopenings, we'd be joined by Muncy Alvarado, who is the executive director of Beckett, a nonprofit public interest legal and educational institute. So, Muncy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I know that Beckett was really at the forefront of the efforts to convince the state of Minnesota that churches should be reopened as part of the governor's wider plans for the state in emerging out of the pandemic. But at this point, before we move into more detail about Minnesota, how many states have opened up and what are the restrictions on the celebration of the sacraments for, at least a public celebration of the sacraments for Catholics?
So you've got more than half of the country that has opened itself up for, no state-level prohibitions on religious worship. So that's about 29 states that don't have any kind of limitations on what you can do, how you can worship, how many people. And then you have about 14 that come in with some prohibitions on religious worship, others on just religious activities. You saw the state of come in and out on a prohibition on the Eucharist. How interesting was that? That was pulled, 2 days later after Archbishop Laurie spoke up about the importance of the Eucharist. And then you have what I call the holdouts. You've got 8 states that have decided that religious worship is not equally treated, is not as essential as businesses or bars or beauty parlors. So that's kind of the lay of the land right now, and you're going to see it move very quickly. And whether that's with litigation or some advocacy on behalf of religious groups and leaders, it's going to change.
So what are some of the key takeaways from what happened in Minnesota for people to be aware of?
So I think there are two important takeaways that I would note. One is help in numbers. It was the first time that the Catholic Church, that a conference of Catholic bishops in a state stood up together and were in solidarity with the Lutheran Church in the state as well. And so it was about religious diversity, but also about showing that the majority of Catholics in the state, led by the bishops, wanted to have a seat at the table to speak with the governor and make a change and make sure that there was parity and equality, at least, at the minimum, for religious services alongside businesses. The second piece is exactly that parity point. Religious worship is not secondary to business, is not secondary to any other kind of activity. Just because you have a crisis doesn't mean that you get rid of religious protections in the First Amendment. Absolutely not. If anything, you need them more. And you need to remind the government that even in moments of crisis, religious worship comes just alongside any other kind of activity. And so opening up for worship, for mass, for any kind of, for funeral masses, all of these are activities that are essential for human beings to flourish. And if we can sit down at a bar and we can go and hang out at Home Depot, we should definitely be able to safely and carefully join together in celebrating the sacraments. And that careful point is important, too, because the bishops did have a very worthwhile and carefully put-together protocol they submitted to the health commissioner and received no response on until they decided to have an act of civil disobedience.
Yes, you know what you're talking about right there, that responsibility that, the bishops in Minnesota throughout the state took upon themselves to prepare themselves for safely, responsibly returning to the sacraments, I guess the flock returning to the sacraments. I think that's really important to recognize. I mean, they have stepped forward to do this safely, and they've done their own consulting on how to do that. And the Register has covered well, I think, these protocols and guidelines that have been put out for how to safely return. But I've been increasingly growing, I guess, very appreciative of the bishops and Catholics in general who are grouping together and really fighting for this safe return to the sacraments. I think it's very, very important, as you said, that we recognize this as something essential and something that we have to return to. So I've been very appreciative of the work that Beckett is doing on this, and also of this wonderful map that you have on the Beckett's website showing the states and where they are. I think it's worth everybody, looking up this map. Can you tell us where we can find it?
Sure. If you go to beckettlaw.org/case/Minnesota churches, or even if you just go to beckettlaw.org and type in Minnesota, it's the first thing that pops up. And it's a landscape map that shows you where you have these reopening guidelines where you don't have anything for churches. But the point that you make about rigorous standards for and protocols for hygiene and social distancing, the church is taking this really, really seriously, and they developed their protocol in line with recommendations from the World Health Organization, with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they're even more rigorous than what's recommended by the CDC. And so when you realize that retailers were being allowed to open at 50%, and the churches were only asking for 25 to 33%, right? They recognize that these are gathering places where people are going to want to naturally be close together in community. They are preparing for the reality that people are not going to be allowed to do that, and making sure that they've spoken to the faithful so that when they do come back, they're able to do it safely and carefully. And that is a reality that most people miss because they're scared. And we all know what happens when fear rules the day rather than preparation and courage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I wish that every business was taking the responsibility seriously in the way that the church has, because I certainly have been in places where I feel like precautions are way too laxed. So it's something for us mm-hmm. to be proud of and to really encourage our churches in. There's states that have not really complied with everything that our president has asked for in terms of reopening the churches. Who are some of the outliers, I should say?
Some of the clear outliers are California, of course. You've got a couple of areas in Wisconsin, some cities after governors come out with positive lifting some of the restrictions. Some cities come back and say, hey, we're not ready. That to me is a problem, just because, again, it's that point of responsibility. Who would actually open up their church if they didn't think their community was ready? In Minnesota, that was actually one of the points that Archbishop Hebda made, where he said, I am fighting for people to be able to open up their churches because I think it's the right thing to do. However, there are some communities where the parish priest has decided that either the spread level was too high or contagion, or maybe it is that the population that goes to Mass was at high risk, you know, mostly elderly, and they decided to hold off on opening or have smaller, more restricted gatherings to continue the sacraments. The prudential care that has gone into making these decisions is real, and it's offensive to think that at a citywide level and even at a local level, a shepherd wouldn't be able to take care of their flock appropriately and understand what their needs and the risks associated with opening up actually are. They probably know much better than those city officials.
Now, Monse, as we're looking at this reopening, and heaven forbid that the day may come when we have another pandemic like this, What are some of the lessons that you hope both the judiciary but also state and local authorities can come away with the next time we have a crisis like this?
The big takeaway is local is best, and working through some of these very broad protections that were put in place, or restrictions as I would like to call them, I actually don't think that we did the right thing in allowing people to become depressed and over-reliant on, you know, substances and substance abuse, the rise in domestic violence, the rise in phone calls in suicide hotlines. We allowed this to go on too long. Let's not even talk about what's going on with children and economic downturn for high-risk communities and low-income communities. The fact that we have, I hope that we will walk away learning about the importance of, you know, work and dignity, but also taking care of vulnerable populations who can't afford to be home right now and can't afford not to have income, and what that's doing to them. But also, I hope that this will be a lesson in remembering, again, that the First Amendment doesn't disappear when you have a crisis, and that we should lean on and bring religious leaders to the table alongside business leaders. So most of these states that are kind of red on our map, right, Oregon, Nevada, Washington State, Rhode Island, these states that decided that they would have conversations with everyone except the religious leaders. They didn't bring them in. They don't have reopening plans for them. They are treating them like the unknown kind of eccentric uncle, right? Religious freedom is not the eccentric uncle of our civil rights and our First Amendment rights and our human rights. It's front and center. And so we shouldn't be bringing the religious leaders to the table last. They should be the first ones that we talk to get an understanding for what the needs of our communities really are.
Absolutely. You know, you've said it so well, and I think that in some ways this is a sign of how sweeping secularization can be and relativism can be. This is something the Register tries to highlight all the time as we seek to evangelize and to bring the truth to people as well as the news. But Beckett does this very well in protecting religion and worshipers' place in the public square. So, Monsi Alvarado, thank you so much for being with us today. And I'd love to point our readers in the direction of a news story that they can read to get a better handle on this whole topic. The title is President Trump: Churches Should Reopen Right Now. And this features some of what we've spoken about here with Monsi. When we come back, we'll be talking to Loretta Brown about the abortion battle in the midst of the pandemic crisis. This is Register Radio on EWTN. More when we return.
In these uncertain times, Catholics depend on EWTN's National Catholic Register. The Register is so much more than a newspaper. It's your faith, your life, your source of information and spiritual resources. The Register is uplifting, redemptive journalism, interviews with Catholic leaders and newsmakers, liturgical coverage, health, financial, and political topics, and analysis of the key issues you care most about. EWTN's National Catholic Register covers every aspect of the Catholic faith that impacts your world. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen. As the Trump administration has moved to defund the World Health Organization over accusations that it mishandled the response to the coronavirus pandemic, both the WHO and the United Nations Population Fund have continued to demonstrate their allegiance to the abortion lobby. So reads the lead of a story recently written by the Register's national correspondent, Loretta Brown. Loretta has been following several stories that relate to abortion over the past few months, and she's with us now to talk about the latest. Welcome, Loretta.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've had quite a few stories on the abortion beat, I guess. It's a terrible beat, but it is something that you tend to follow. And, of course, this recent story, which is printed in our print edition and is online as well, is about the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the UN really digging into abortion advocacy. What has happened?
Well, yeah, this story looks at how they have made abortion part of their coronavirus response, like humanitarian response to coronavirus. And it was interesting because the Trump administration actually went ahead and called them out on it, which it was great to see them go ahead and say, like, the UN should not use this crisis as an opportunity to advance access to abortion as an essential service. So that's a quote from the letter that John Barza, the acting administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, sent to the UN. And so I kind of just took a look at what's going on here with their response to coronavirus in terms of abortion. And some of the things I found really surprised me. Like, I was looking at some of their response plan links for if you're just looking, okay, what can I do for my health care if I'm in an area affected by the coronavirus? And one of them is a link about self-care. And in that, it's sexual, you know, reproductive health self-care is included abortion, like having an abortion, giving yourself an abortion through abortion pills, which is something that, you know, they say you can do at home without medical supervision, which is not, you know, which is not in line with FDA
right.
guidelines, safety guidelines,
right.
common sense in some ways, because for them to put that on their website, they don't know if maybe like a 13-year-old girl is reading that someone with a specific pregnancy condition. This isn't like some one size fits all.
And you've written about that as well. It, you know, early on in the pandemic, when Planned Parenthood was pushing to be recognized as an essential service, and in many places they were not, there was battles in Texas and all of this. You wrote about how the abortion pills were you know becoming, I guess, a more available, and that there were many dangers. You spoke to medical professionals who listed the dangers of this. So it's really concerning that these world health organizations are really promoting something that is very unhealthy and could be life-threatening. And in fact, one of the things that John Barza's letter really reminds me of is actually something Pope Francis has said, which is we should not be exporting our ideology and particularly this kind of relativistic ideology, this pro-abortion ideology, that we shouldn't be exporting this all over the world. And that certainly sounds to me like what is happening here in this push by the WHO and the UN.
Yeah, certainly. And it was interesting. One of the experts I talked to about this who's been following, you know, the UN actions on abortion for quite some time, Rebecca Oas with the Center for Family and Human Rights, she pointed out that this wasn't even in their mandate, right? So she and others I talked to as well actually talked about how they had an agreement, that the Cairo Agreement, where they, in 1994, where their consensus was that the legality of abortion and the circumstances of that are for the nations in the UN to determine. The UN, the World Health Organization, the UNFPA, they should not be putting out these guidances from these just kind of agency bureaucrats about what level of abortion access different countries should have, because it's not even their job.
So has the Trump administration been effective at all in kind of curbing the UN or the WHO?
Well, I think it's very significant that they called this out. And I think more so than anything I've ever seen and even just been able to find looking back at the history of this, they have been very outspoken at the very least as saying, you know, listen, this the UN should not be involved with abortion. And So that's been encouraging. There was something that some of the folks I talked to talked about. The Trump administration could take a closer look at funding ties, right? So if the U.S. is continuing to fund parts of the World Health Organization, will they partner with International Planned Parenthood and other international abortion groups? According to the Mexico City policy and different other policies, they say, oh, well, we're not directly going to partner with groups that provide abortions. Sometimes are still in partnership with coalitions that some of the groups in there provide abortions. And so, you know, through these different funding streams, there can still be U.S. funding going to abortions. So basically the encouragement was to be vigilant for that and to crack down on, you know, the entities within the U.N. promoting abortion and being able to say, no, U.S. funds shouldn't be going to that.
Speaking of funds, I mean, this week it was revealed that Planned Parenthood had received federal funds related to the relief, and of course that there's a push that those funds be returned because no federal funds should be going to Planned Parenthood. So that's an interesting story that we'll continue to follow. But I did want to talk to you about something else that has come I guess it's been talked about a lot in the last week, especially in the blogosphere, the pro-life and Catholic blogosphere. And that's this film, AKA Jane Roe. It's a documentary that aired on FX and on FX Hulu last weekend. And this is a film that is supposed to be showing the real Norma McCorvey. That is Jane Roe, the woman who helped, whose story, I guess, helped to get abortion legalized throughout the country. And of course, in the middle of her life, she converted from the pro-choice side, pro-abortion side, to the pro-life side. And so this documentary basically says that that she was exploited. You watched it. I watched it. What did you think about it?
You know, the first thing that I thought of after sitting down and watching all of it was how little Norma McCorvey actually gets to say in the documentary. I was very much looking forward to getting to see a whole conversation with her and, you know, her explaining and discussing her journey in this, you know, being in the abortion movement, going to the pro-life movement, and the different quotes they had in the preview. More of an explanation of that, you know, of this, what seemed to be another, flip-flop on this. But what disappointed me is that they have some moments of talking with her, and she does say, you know, those quotes that sound like she changed her mind on the issue, but that she isn't pressed on it. There aren't follow-up questions. It's very frustrating. Because I think for a lot of people, there were immediate questions that come to mind is if you were paid, you know, she says, I took their money. They took me out in front of the cameras, told me what to say. I'm an actress. I did it well. You know, she seems to imply this was an act. And it's just all these questions about like, well, okay, why did you convert, you know, from the evangelical movement to Catholicism partway through your life? Why were you so outspoken on this issue? You know, why are you confessing this now? Why, you know, there are all these questions that are just very naturally raised that aren't addressed at all. I noticed a lot of the reviews made a note of, like, the documentary has a lot of historical footage recounting what we already know. Mm-hmm. But it had that unique chance of sitting down with her, and they didn't really seem to dig deep into what Norma McCorvey makes of all this, you know?
Is there any indication, Loretta, that we'll at any time see sort of the unedited or the complete interviews that they might have done with her? Because, as you note, this seems to be heavily edited and very carefully constructed.
Yeah, I had noticed that pro-lifers are calling for a release of the unedited footage, and I was looking at the director, Nick Sweeney. He was interviewed about making the documentary, and he doesn't really answer those. He kind of dances around that question of, like, well, what else did she say? Did you follow up? You know, this sort of thing. He doesn't directly address that. It would be great if we could see the full, right, you know, the full version of this. I don't know if we're going to get to do that, and... you know, the bottom line is just these quotes from her, there could be just a lot of different contexts. She could have been, you know, I've heard people say she could have been talking about her past. She could have been, you know, venting about something. And, you know, there's just so many ways that this could have been said. And since we didn't get to see a full conversation, it just, you know, we can't know. And unfortunately, she's passed away. So there's not a way to ask her, you know.
That's right. And one of the things that struck me is that one of the voices, he was a pastor, an evangelical pastor who was a leader in the pro-life movement for many, many, many years, who helped her to come to the forefront and to witness to life and all of this in front of cameras, etc. He has flipped sides. So he is no longer a pro-life advocate. He is a pro-choice advocate and has been advocating for many years. His name is Rob Schenck, and he is in this saying, yes, we instrumentalized her. Yes, we used her. I wish Norma McCorvey could have told her own story. But, you know, the film isn't honest about how he changed sides. And I find that very disappointing because he has become a pro-choice advocate. And it seems to me that she's still being used. She was used by the pro-lifers. Well, now she's still being used. She's being used in the midst of an election year. This documentary was taken 3 years ago. The film was, she died 3 years ago. And so why is it happening now? Anyway, Deacon Stephen Graydonis, who's our film critic at the Register, has written a great review of this. It's called Unraveling the Complicated Life of Norma McCorvey. And I think he does a really good job of asking some of the unanswered questions that this film raises. But it should be looked at, I think, with a little bit of suspicion, but also, you know, maybe some sadness, because I think she certainly seemed to be very conflicted near the end of her life, and you hope that she had the support that she needed from the pro-lifers who were close to her for so many years. So, Loretta, thank you so much for covering all of these kind of difficult stories related to abortion. You're always good on this particular beat, and I certainly appreciate it. And for our listeners, remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.